From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. For your Thanksgiving holiday today, we're bringing you a few interviews from Radio Times past about the quirks of the human condition. We'll hear from Melissa Dahl, author of Cringeworthy, about all things awkward, uncomfortable silences, embarrassing conversations, and those mildly humiliating moments that we all endure. Daniel Pink talks to us about our changing minds and its effect on decision-making. His latest book is titled When. But first, we'll listen to my discussion with Dolly Chugg about how to counter our unconscious perceptions. Her book, The Person You Want to Be, is steeped in research and psychological data about our internal biases. That's all coming ahead when Radio Times continues after the news. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and for your Thanksgiving Day today, we bring you three stories from Radio Times past, ones that discuss the universal human condition. First up, how to be a good person. While the majority of us either consider ourselves to be a good person or aspire to be a good person, our internal biases can often act as a barrier. Author, psychologist Dolly Chugg says that we can do more to fight our impulses and confront biases in ourselves and in the world around us. That's what her book, The Person You Meant to Be, is all about. Here's a portion of our conversation recorded last year. So let's begin with some really basic stuff here. What you seem to be saying is that most of us, and I'm assuming, you know, 90-some percent of us, do want to be a good person and perhaps want to be a better person than we actually are. But do we know ourselves?
Yeah, so that's the issue. Now, let's begin with what you define as a good person, what I define as a good person, what every other person may not be the same. We want to be clear that most people, including, by the way, white nationalists, see themselves as good people. Our minds are able to create the vision and match it up to whatever it is we care about. Good enough is a really interesting phrasing around it. What I'm pushing for with goodish is a higher standard. And by higher standard, I mean, what happens when you make the mistakes? If the mistakes are inevitable, and they are, according to the science, what happens next? And goodish says, I'm going to expect the mistakes. I'm going to expect to be a work in progress. And so when I make the mistakes, I am accountable for them. I will own them. And that's where I like the idea that goodish is pushing us towards holding ourselves more accountable, as you said, knowing ourselves better, as opposed to holding this unicorn idea that isn't realistic.
Do we think then we are better than others perceive us to be?
Yeah.
And I'm speaking very broadly here.
Yeah. So we are remarkably capable of finding, you know, if someone else were to submit that on their expense report, we would roll our eyes a little bit. But we think to ourselves, no, we talked about work at that dinner. We are remarkably able. We also know our own inner motivations better than we know the motivations of others. And so we can tap into the benefit of the doubt piece more easily when we look at ourselves. So for lots of reasons, both virtuous and more just practical, we will see ourselves better than others will typically see us.
In a sense, I mean, it sounds like we're pretty able to justify our own behavior to ourselves.
Yes, remarkably. In fact, we almost have to. It's a survival mechanism. So psychologists refer to self-threat. Self-threat is any identity you care about. I care about being seen as a good mom. I care about being seen as a good professional. Any identity I care about being seen as a good person. Anything that threatens it, whether it's coming from inside me or from someone outside me, I go into the red zone, and so does everyone else. And that's a very human response to psychological protection. What happens when we're in the red zone depends on our belief of whether or not we can actually recover and learn in that moment. And there's some interesting research that can help guide us on that.
And is the red zone, oh, no, I'm not?
Oh, no, I'm not.
Or you are wrong?
How dare you
say this?
You have no idea. I help so many people. Yes. The red zone is one that's characterized by either defensiveness, or it can also be characterized by shame. The emotion of shame is paralyzing. When we feel shame, our whole being is called into question, and we tend to become more passive than active.
And shame, I mean, I always think of shame as this physical, there's a physical feeling that goes with feeling ashamed. You can feel it in your body.
That's fascinating. And I don't know that research, but I bet it's out there that would connect those physical feelings to shame. Shame is actually, people who study moral emotions like shame and guilt distinguish between the two. Shame leads to less action. Guilt leads to more. And the difference between the two is when I feel shame, I'm feeling something about myself as a whole. When I feel guilt, I'm feeling something about my behaviors. And when I, if I'm honed in on a behavior, I can address the behavior. So I actually act more from guilt and less from shame.
So let's flip it. And instead of being enraged or feeling defensive or shame, if someone says, you know, you really hurt my feelings, or I was really offended when you said X, Y, or Z. What would a good person do?
Well, what a good person would do is say, I'm really sorry you're offended, or that's not what I meant. Let me explain what I meant. What a good person would do is activate what Carol Dweck, psychologist at Stanford, calls a growth mindset. So in a growth mindset, you view yourself as a work in progress. You're a goodish person, work in progress. And when someone says that was really offensive, you say, I'd like to learn more. Do you have time to tell me? Tell me more. I have a colleague who I didn't know well at all, like barely knew to say hello in the hallways by name. And he had been given the task of introducing a speaker, someone in our group, and he introduced her. And I really was taken, like, in a bad way by the introduction. It felt like it diminished her. She was a woman of color. I was really bristling afterwards. And I, of course, did what any reasonable person would do. I went and told everyone behind his back how terrible that was.
I was wondering where you were going with that.
And then one of my friends, you know, finally said, you know, it's fine that you're telling everyone else this. How about you go share it with him so he could learn from it? And I was like, no way. You know, I'm going to go tell this guy, this white male that I think he said something sexist and racist. Like, no. And she pushed me to do it. And her name is Christina Olson. She's a wonderful psychologist. And I went to his door and sheepishly knocked and said, I don't know if you know who I am, but I really think your introduction was inappropriate.
And was that the word you used?
I think I used something like that. And I may have thrown in racist and sexist. And he said, do you have time to come in? I would really love to hear more.
Wow.
Todd Rogers is now one of my closest friends.
Right.
That wasn't just a line. He really wanted to hear more. He was absolutely open to the fact that he had a blind spot there. That's what we do when we're goodish people, is we welcome the opportunity. That doesn't mean we always in the end are going to agree to every critique of ourselves. But what if we honor the fact that someone had the courage to speak up?
And were you able to then to did you feel comfortable enough to say, since he opened the door to this, to be honest with him and to give him your honest assessment of what you heard and observed?
Yeah, I mean, I will grant that I tiptoed. Like, I was sort of, the more he was open, the more I was open, because I was absolutely, I describe myself in this book as a semi-bold person. I am not at all a firebrand. I am not the one who's going to have all the courage and do all the brave things. This was a big moment for me and a scary one.
And a scary one. There's another way to look at that anecdote, which is also to say, is it easier for us to recognize bias, racism, sexism in other people than we do in ourselves?
It is. The studies would support that. That it is, the noticing is, of course, again, for all the reasons we talked about earlier, that we have access to our own motivations and not to others. We are able to see it. That said, we also actually, noticing the stuff that's baked in around us also escapes a lot of us. You know, I think a lot of us are seeing it with the Me Too movement right now. You know, those of us who are women of a certain age grew up with a lot of stuff that we frankly just accepted. And it wasn't like we were grappling a lot with it. We were sort of normalizing it ourselves in certain cases. And now when we look and we notice through different eyes, we see things that we were just assuming were baked into how things were. That's part of what happens. You open the fridge and you look for the butter. And you can, who finished the butter and didn't put it on the list? There's no butter here. And then someone shows you the butter right in front of you. It is a completely part of how our minds work that a lot of stuff is right in front of us, but we don't notice it.
Help us understand then unconscious bias.
Yes, exactly. And sometimes unconscious bias is also called implicit bias. We can use those terms interchangeably. So if we continue with this train of thought that a lot of the work of the brain is happening outside of our awareness, and that's a good thing. That's why we're able to do the things that humans do. That also means that there's content in our brain that we aren't aware is bubbling up. And so, for example, if I say peanut butter, you say?
Jelly.
Exactly. If I say twinkle, twinkle, you say?
Little star.
You didn't have to think about that. That was sitting back there, and it's not probably, unless you happen to have a very specific memory around those things, you don't know when they became associated in your mind. Well, there's lots of other things associated in our mind as well. And what cognitive psychologists have discovered is that how quickly we can associate two things, peanut butter, jelly, also reflects how strongly associated they are in our brains.
You did an interesting study with some other researchers having to do with implicit bias, I guess we should say, sending out something like a letter from candidates with various different names asking for a 10-minute meeting.
Yeah.
Sending out to something like 6,500 professors across all sorts of disciplines. First of all, different kinds of signatures. What kinds of names were, I guess, made or used up for this?
Yes.
Made up for this.
So we created names that were either male-sounding or female-sounding using a gender binary, and white-sounding, black-sounding, Hispanic-sounding, Chinese-sounding, or Indian-sounding. Mm-hmm. So those two genders, five race ethnicities, if you cross them, we have about 10 identities. And so each professor, these are real professors in their real inboxes. They don't know they're part of a study. We debrief them later. Get an email that's actually pretty typical for professors to get saying, I'm interested in your research. Would you be willing to meet, as you said? And the question, the dependent variable we were interested in is who would write back and who wouldn't. And this is a cold call email. They're really not obligated to write back. We get a lot of these. It's very hard to keep up with all of them. And we are the way we analyzed the data was we were interested in our white male students, how their response rate compared to the non-white male students. And I should mention, by the way, even though we get a lot of these emails and can't respond to all of them, they do have a meaningful impact on PhD admissions. It's not unusual for these meetings and conversations to lead to actual mentorships. And my co-authors, Katie Milkman, who lives here in Philadelphia, and Madhupe Akinola at Columbia, all three of us had sent these kinds of emails before we were in
our PhD. So you were one of those students.
Yes, we are. And I'm Indian American. Madhupe is African American, and Katie is white American. So we were fascinated by this question. Here's what happened. Our white males, 87% of them received a response from the professors. Our non-white male students, 62% received a response. That's a really...
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Meaningful difference on something that we don't usually measure. This is a very informal behavior with meaningful consequences. And I want to add, we didn't measure. We don't know if that was unconscious bias or not, right?
That was my next question.
Oh, thank you.
Is that a sign of unconscious bias?
We don't know for sure. As a scientist, I have to tell you, I have no idea. Right. As someone who lives in the world and works in academia, I have to say, I got to believe some of it's unconscious bias. I work with colleagues who care deeply about diversity and inclusion. I don't think this can all be explained by conscious bias.
That was my September 2018 conversation with Dolly Chugg. She's an associate professor of management and organization at the Stern School of Business at New York University, and her book is titled The Person You Mean to Be. Up next, time. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. timing. It matters in everything, in surgery, in the law, at school, on American Idol, and in life. Science writer Daniel Pink looked at the research into timing in his latest book. It's titled When. In this segment of the show, we'll talk about the ebb and flow of time in a day, our own biological rhythms, and how they impact both decision-making and success in our lives. Did you write this book because you had a problem with time and timing?
Your
own personal problems?
I did. I had. Well, I have all kinds of personal problems, but one dimension, the temporal.
We'll just deal with this one.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yes, I did. I found myself making all kinds of those decisions in my own life. When should I do this kind of work? When should I start a project? When should I abandon a project? Even things like when should I exercise during the day? And I was making those decisions in a very sloppy way. I wanted to make them in a more intelligent way. So I looked around for guidance. And to my surprise, I was really surprised by this. It didn't exist, and then that frustration turned to curiosity. I said, "Okay, come on, someone's had to be looking at this," and that took me down this rabbit hole of research for a couple of years. Where it turns out there's an enormous amount of research on this question. The challenge is that it's splattered across literally dozens of different disciplines in the social sciences and the physical sciences. There's a whole field called chronobiology. And what's interesting is that all these scholars in these disparate fields are asking very similar questions. What's the effect of time of day on how we feel and what we do? How do beginnings affect us? How do midpoints affect us? How do endings affect us? And what I tried to do is just harvest that research and try to give us some evidence-based ways to make better, smarter decisions about when to do things.
And I want to pick up on all of that. I have to say, though, that radio has taught me something about time and timing. In part, there's a clock over your head. There are very specific points where I have to end a discussion, get back in a discussion. There are the interviews are an hour. Sometimes they feel like five. Sometimes they feel like 5 minutes. And the time is very subjective and feels very flexible.
Right. Well, that's our perception of time. I mean, when you get into the issue of time itself, it is heady, to put it mildly. Right. Time is an incredibly abstract concept. And, you know, you have both physicists and philosophers, people coming from very different ends of the academic spectrum, trying to make sense of it. And in our own lives, we try to make sense of it, too. One way we try to make sense of time is by corralling it. And so one of the things that I discovered in doing this research, Marty, is that these things that I thought were sort of natural units of time, a second, an hour, totally made up. I mean, they're just things that human beings have done in response to that sort of sense. Oh, my gosh, time is so elusive. It's so abstract. I got to put some fences around it. So minutes and hours and seconds and weeks, those are things that human beings have created. There's nothing natural about them. There is something natural about the day. And so that ends up playing a big role in how we accommodate ourselves to time.
In fact, there is a kind of a rhythm to the day. And you also ask us all as readers, are you a lark, are you an owl, or are you a third bird? I am a lark. I'm an early morning person. That's just sort of the way I'm built.
Yeah.
How about you?
I am in the middle, but larky.
Larky.
I'm not a lark, but larky. I come out toward the lark side of the spectrum, but not a full-fledged lark. And this is actually really important because that's what's called a chronotype, and it's the first step in figuring out at the unit of a day what's the right time to do certain things. And so your first task is, you know, are you a lark or are you an owl? There's a very simple back-of-the-envelope way that people can do it. You basically take the time. On a free day, a day I don't have to get up to an alarm clock, I typically will go to sleep at about midnight and wake up at about 8.
Wow.
Okay? So that gives me a midpoint of sleep of 4 a.m. And that's what you try to figure out. What's your midpoint of sleep on days when you don't have to get up to an alarm clock? And if it's 3:30 or before, you're a lark. If it's 5:30 or after, you're an owl. And if it's in the middle, you are a third bird. So I'm, you know, a third bird leaning toward larkiness. And what a massive researchers have found is that about 80% of us, that is 20% of us are 20% of us are owls. About 80% of us move through the day in the following order: a peak, a trough, a recovery. Our mood goes up, our mood dips significantly, and our mood recovers. That has an effect on performance too. Owls, very complicated people, these owls. These people who are evening-oriented.
The late-night people.
The late-night people. The world is I think the corporate world is designed to crush their spirits, actually. It's a it's hard being an owl. They tend to move in the reverse direction, recovery, trough, peak. And what the research shows is that if we understand these three broad stages of the day, we can do certain work at certain kinds of the day and do better at it.
Well, in fact, you have a couple of charts here. People feel increasingly happy throughout the morning, less happy in the afternoon. That's that trough. And then happier again in the evening. That's most people.
That's most people because 80% of us are either in the middle or larks. Owls are, again, as I said, far more complicated.
This is based in part on some research of 500 million tweets.
Oh, well, that's a wonderful piece of research.
And it was 500 million, I should say.
I mean, this is the way that scholars are doing research these days is quite fascinating because there's so much data out there and the tools for analyzing the data are so great. So this is a study done by two researchers at Cornell, and they used a program that think of it as a very powerful piece of software that can analyze text. In all kinds of dimensions. And in this particular case, that they were looking at the emotional level of words that were used. So you can use novels, you can use newspaper articles, you can use just massive amounts of text, throw it into this program and analyze it. Well, they decided to use, as you said, this body of text of 500 million tweets, half a billion tweets from 2.5 million people.
The thought of going through half a billion tweets is just almost nauseating.
Well, imagine doing it, but that's why we have software, because software doesn't get nauseated, all right, like you and I do, all right? So, but imagine, seriously, that's a great point, because think about an individual researcher, you or me or an individual journalist, going through half a billion tweets.
Yeah.
I mean, you would just pack it up at probably after 1,000. But software doesn't get tired, software doesn't get bored, software doesn't get sickened by the harshness of people's words. So they look at the emotional level of the words. Is it positive sentiment or negative sentiment? And then they plot it out against time of day. And what they found was this predictable pattern in mood. Rising mood in the morning, declining mood in the early afternoon to mid-afternoon, and then recovering mood later in the day. And over and over and over again, no matter the methodology, that's what scholars are finding about a pattern of mood over the course of the day.
Which, if you took that, you'd say, well, then I'm going to make all my important decisions in the morning. I'm going to have all my surgery scheduled in the morning. I hope that the judge will render my verdict in the morning as well. Should that be our takeaway?
No, although it's part of the takeaway. Here's what we know, all right? During that peak period, again, which for most of us is the morning, for owls is later in the day, we are very high on vigilance. That's the word that comes out in all of these pieces of research. We're very vigilant. What does that mean? Vigilance means you're able to bat away distractions. That makes it this peak period the ideal time for analytic work, work that requires heads down, focus, attention, energy, writing a report, analyzing data, doing those kinds of things. So we should be doing our analytic work then. During the trough, we'll talk about the trough for a moment. That's a pretty bad time, as you alluded to.
And this is mid-afternoon, right?
This is basically, yeah, early to mid-afternoon. There's some bad stuff that happens then. I mean, if you look at – you mentioned surgery. Seriously, I would not let anybody in my family willingly go into a hospital, have surgery, or go to an important doctor's appointment in the afternoon. The data here are overwhelming. Anesthesia errors are 4 times more likely at 3 p.m. than at 9 a.m. Doctors performing colonoscopies find half as many polyps in afternoon exams versus morning exams for the same population. Wow. Hand washing in hospitals declines and this is research that hand washing research was done partly by Katie Milkman, who's here at the University of Pennsylvania. Massive decline in hand washing in hospitals in the afternoon. And so even if you look at something like traffic accidents, obviously you're going to be more traffic accidents when there are more cars on the road. But once you control for that, the most dangerous time to be on the road is 4 to 6 a.m., not surprisingly.
Right. Early morning.
Early morning. It's dark outside. You know, what are people doing out then? The second most dangerous time is 2 to 4 p.m.
Hmm.
You look even at things like standardized test scores for students. Big drop during that.
Well, isn't that an argument? Then let's at least shove all these more sort of vigilant requiring
oh, yes, absolutely.
The morning.
You shove the vigilance, the tasks that require vigilance to the morning, and then do a lot of our administrative work, stuff that doesn't require a heavy cognitive load in that trough period. But I don't want to suggest that everything that's important belongs in that peak period, because let's go to the recovery stage. The recovery stage is actually really interesting. What we have is we have rising mood. Okay, so our mood is going back up. However, we're less vigilant. Now, that seems like a bug, but it's really a feature in some cases. So elevated mood and lack of lower vigilance makes it a good time for certain creative things, for brainstorming ideas, for iterating things like that. And so
there are fewer inhibitions in a way?
Exactly. That's precisely what it is. It's all about inhibitions. And so if you think about brainstorming, if people feel inhibited, they're not going to be as good brainstormers. If you have someone – and we've been in these meetings before. Hey, let's brainstorm. And then there's some guy sitting there. That's a terrible idea. That's a terrible idea. He's hyper-vigilant and sort of annoying, batting away those ideas. And anyway, what this distills to is a set of design principles that I think are actually pretty powerful. We should be doing our analytic work during the peak, our administrative work during the trough, and our insight and creative work during the recovery. And what the research is telling us is that time of day, just time of day alone, explains about 20% of the variance in how people perform on tasks requiring brain power. And it's essentially true for everybody. It's because you are a biological creature. And one of the things we have to get our minds around is, and no one ever tells you this in school, no one ever tells you this at work, our cognitive abilities don't stay the same throughout the day. Period. Full stop. They change. And that's just part of what it is to be human. That's not a moral weakness or a personal flaw. It's just the way human beings are wired. And the danger is ignoring that or not doing anything about it.
Well, you make a case, and I guess scientists are making a case for things like a short nap during the day or taking a break, certain kinds of breaks during the day that can help restore some of those intellectual juices.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, well, but the breaks is interesting. In my view, the science of breaks is where the science of sleep was not that long ago. 15 years ago, people who pulled all-nighters were heroes. Now, what's happened is that we know the science of sleep has deepened, but we've had actually a public discussion about the science, and I think it's really changed at least some of our behavior. We no longer deify that guy who goes without sleep. We think he's an idiot. And so I think the same thing is happening with breaks. What we're learning is that we human beings should be taking more breaks. And as you say, Marty, we should be taking certain kinds of breaks. And what we have to do is get past this very kind of puritanical notion that it's the way to get stuff done is to power through all the time, and also that it's somehow morally virtuous to power through. What we know, and I'm a sinner here. I have changed my. I'm saved now, but I was a sinner.
You saw the error of your ways.
The science showed me the error of my ways. I used to believe that that amateurs were the ones who took breaks and professionals didn't take breaks, and it's exactly the opposite. Professionals take breaks. We see this in sports. We see this in music, and so what we have to be is intentional about our breaks. And we know a lot. Again, if you think about these as design principles, we know the sorts of breaks that are most restorative.
Well, one of the things that you write about in here, and this is, again, based on research, which is that judges end up being more lenient after taking a break. Explain how that works.
This is a remarkable study, and there is a lot of – there's some very kind of alarming research on jury and judicial decision-making and how it changes over the course of a day. But this is a reasonably famous study out of Israel about prisoners going for parole before parole judges. And what they found is that early in the day, prisoners had a decent chance of parole, and then it just dropped.
As the day progressed.
As the morning progressed, it dropped. And then you give a judge a break, and she comes back from the break, and suddenly your probability of getting parole goes a lot higher. I mean, these judges made dramatically different decisions before a break and after a break.
You have a lot in here about teenagers. Do rhythms change with age?
Dramatically. What you find is that I don't know how old Nell's kids are, obviously, but little kids, larks. Big time larks, as any parent of little kids knows. They get up early, start running around like crazy people right away. Then, and this is, I think, the most important change in our chronobiology. This is the most important change in our chronobiology in our lifetimes. Around the age of 14, around the age of puberty, people experience a massive shift toward lateness, sometimes 2-3 hours, a period of peak owliness, really, that extends from about age 14 to about age mid-20s. And then, in general, people will return to greater larkiness over time. Men tend to be a little owlier than women. Women return to larkiness a little bit more swiftly than men, recognizing there's still one in five of us are just hardcore owls regardless. But that period, that teen period, 14 to 24, call it, there is a marked change in our chronobiology.
And it looks like the schools that have made that shift, so they're opening instead of 7:15 in the morning, more like 8:30 or maybe even 9, they get results.
Yes, they do.
Students perform better.
Yes, they do. The American Academy of Pediatrics, about 4 years ago, issued a policy statement saying that, imploring schools around America, do not start school for teenagers before 8:30 in the morning. It is contraindicated by everything that we know. The research on school start times, to me, is not a close call. And what's interesting, as you mentioned, Marty, is that schools that have pushed back start times for teenagers, and we're not talking about going crazy here. We're talking about starting school at 9:15, not starting it at 1 in the afternoon, have seen lower dropout rates, higher test scores, less obesity, less depression, fewer car crashes. And when you think about it, it's a little bit sterile to think about the American Academy of Pediatrics policy statement. Instead, picture – your kids' pediatricians and all pediatricians, linking arms and marching down Market Street with signs. I mean, that's what they're saying. And it's all because of that question that Nell asked, is our bodies and our chronobiology change over time?
Let me read an email from Diane. She says, please ask your guest if he was informed at all by Ayurveda, the science of yoga, which is all about nature and our daily cycles. Life cycles. You're nodding your head, yes.
Well, it's interesting because it wasn't informed by that, but I think that those there are several things that are not necessarily all rooted in science that seem to actually be consonant with the science. And so if you look at even the Quran has a lot of writing about sleep, and it's very similar in its spirit to modern sleep science. The same thing is true with certain kinds of yoga practices, even sort of the cultural practice of a siesta, which is basically we're going to take a break during this dip to restore, is consonant with what a lot of the science says. Mm-hmm. So I think what's interesting about that is that some of these practices, again, and with it, these practices that are around the world that aren't rooted in a particular faith, that aren't rooted in a particular culture, seem to be coming.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This intuitive sense that what scientists are telling us is that in a day, we do not remain the same during a day. Our brain changes, our emotion changes, and simply ignoring that is something that's dangerous.
That was my March 2018 interview with science writer Daniel Pink, author of When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. When we get back from the break, things are going to get really awkward. Stay with us. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We're featuring interviews from our archives about some universal human experiences, including feeling awkward. Awkwardness isn't just a teenage emotion that goes away once the braces are off and the pimples disappear. Cringy feelings can last a lifetime. Writer Melissa Dahl has struggled with awkwardness so much that she decided to take a closer look at this misunderstood emotion. I talked with Dahl about what she learned from these embarrassing experiences and about her book. It's called Cringeworthy. Do you have a special affinity for awkwardness?
I think
put it that way.
I think that I do. Yeah. I mean, I started this book wanting to write a book about overcoming awkwardness or avoiding it. And then I wrote exactly the opposite thing about embracing it and kind of finding some joy in this weird little feeling. Every time I sat down to write the book, I mean, writing is really hard, but the subject just cracks me up. So it was really fun.
Were you a particularly awkward child growing up?
Well, I think that that is kind of the difference of what I was looking at versus how a lot of people understand what it is to say awkward. You know, I'm not particularly interested in, like, quote, awkward people. Right. I understand it more as a feeling, something that's happening kind of internally. So, you know, as I was writing this book, people would say to me, like, you know, you don't strike me as particularly awkward. And I would, you know, be like, I'll take the compliment. Thank you. But I feel this way all the time. So yes, I felt that way all the time as a kid. So
are you just a good actor?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah. I think I really am.
Well, you don't talk deeply about your life, but you do say that you moved around as a child a lot.
Yes. Yes.
And perhaps felt like an outsider in school.
Yeah. I mean, I think that every kid and especially every teenager is really hyper aware of social norms and kind of what it takes to be cool at a school. But we moved every 2 years or so. And so I had to kind of like relearn these social norms over and over and over again. So I think it made me really sensitive to the moments that deviate from the norm. So, and maybe more prone to causing them too.
And there is something about adolescence where everything conspires to make us feel awkward.
Absolutely. I mean, it's like self-consciousness is at its peak, you know, social anxiety is at its peak at that age. And I don't know. I think there's reason to believe that those moments never truly leave us. Like in these moments of embarrassment, it's like 13-year-old me is back.
You dispel something that I think a lot of people feel, that when they've made a big blunder or made them feel like a jerk in front of a crowd, this sense that, oh my God, everyone is looking at me, everyone is laughing at me, I am a fool.
Yeah.
And you say, perhaps we should rethink this.
Yeah, there is this, you know, I've written about just like hundreds of studies over the course of my career. And this one is one that's really stayed with me. It's about this thing that these researchers termed the spotlight effect, which is this idea that if you do something stupid in front of other people, we assume more people are looking than really are. We assume more people are remembering than really are. And kind of an interesting exercise to do is to, I don't know, try to remember like something embarrassing your high school best friend did. And maybe you can think of it, but it doesn't come as easily as something embarrassing you did, you know? Or certainly something that she did back then never comes back to haunt me, you know? Like people just don't care as much as we think that they do, which is really nice for. Yeah.
I mean, nice because we can sort of know that if we made a fool of ourselves, probably not that many people notice.
Yes, it is a very freeing message for the overly self-conscious.
You did there was a study about a Barry Manilow shirt.
Yeah, yeah. This is this famous study that was done, I think, in 2000, where they had folks show up to participate in an experiment, but they told one person to show up late. And so he's supposed to come into the room with the rest of the folks in the experiment. But before he goes in, they're like, okay, put this oversized Barry Manilow t-shirt on. We'll explain it later. And so he puts it on and goes into the room. And, you know, everybody looks at him because he's coming in late. And then the experimenter comes back and is like, oh, actually, you know what? You came too late. We'll just like do the experiment with you privately. And so takes him back out and, you know, asks them a bunch of different things. But what he really wanted to know is this one question, which is how many people do you think noticed the t-shirt you were wearing? And all these people, they basically doubled how many people actually noticed. So people did notice, but just not nearly as many as we think. So
is there kind of a weird insecure, narcissism is probably too strong a word, but a kind of insecurity mixed with narcissism? I mean, we do think the world revolves around us.
Yeah. This is so interesting, actually. I cut this out of the book, but back in, like, I think the 70s, when researchers were kind of studying shyness and self-consciousness, there was a lot of research claiming that it was a form of narcissism.
Oh, well, and even the idea of taking the focus off oneself and putting it on the other person.
Absolutely.
That can be such a relief.
Yes, absolutely. The researchers who study self-consciousness say that basically that is one way out of it, to focus on other people. So that really helps.
Awkward sex talk. I mean, you don't even need to say awkward there.
Yeah, awkward sex talk is, there's nothing more awkward than that. Well, there probably are a few things, but it's up there.
It certainly is up there. But emotion versus what, trait?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so researchers who study like boredom think of it as either like a trait or a state. And I just became more interested in awkwardness as kind of a state, you know, something that we feel and something that we kind of share together, you know. I'm not sure I wonder how the Eugene Levy character in that is, like, whether he felt awkward, whether he knew he was making it awkward for everybody and the viewing audience, you know. But it is something that just kind of, like, it's in the air and it kind of, like, spreads to everyone in the room and we all share it together. So, yeah.
Let me read an email from Melanie. I once walked from a bathroom in the back of a coffee shop all the way to the front during a crowded poetry reading with my skirt tucked into my underwear, mm-hmm. and not just any underwear. It was a thong.
Oh,
so
that's fabulous.
Awkward.
Yes, yes. Oh, my gosh.
We can all identify with that, Melanie.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I tell a story in the book of that happened to me at my first internship out of college. I was at MSNBC.com and just wandered out of the bathroom with my skirt tucked into my tights. And people definitely saw and pointed and laughed. So,
because some of what you have in here is actual advice. I mean, how to help people handle some of these awkward moments. Mm-hmm. What do you suggest to Melanie and all of us who can relate to Melanie?
Well, I think if that's something that comes back to haunt her, you know, like that moment does for me, or it kind of used to for me, and writing the book kind of helped, has helped. One thing that I kind of do is just to kind of zoom out when those moments come back to me, and just, yes, it was embarrassing, to not discount that, but just, is it the most embarrassing that's ever happened to anybody? You know, it's such a cliche, almost cliche it of is. Embarrassing moments, you know, and it's happened to everybody. You're not the only person this has happened to. It happened to me. So,
me too.
That helps me.
Kind of me too. An email from Anne. My Brooklyn cousins would never interact with anyone without making funny but fairly hurtful comments about them. Could that contribute to hypersensitivity, as I've always had the feeling that people were making fun of me? And which raises the question whether some people are just more sensitive to these awkward moments than other people that might be able to brush them off.
Oh, I certainly think so. Yeah, I think I am much more sensitive to these moments than a lot of people. That's why I wrote a whole book about it. but I would rather be this way. You know, I mean, other people's feedback can be valuable. And it's a good thing to pay attention to social norms and whether you're whether it's worth following them and whether you are following them. I would rather be this way, and I hope you are too. It's a really good thing. It says nice things about you.
There's some interesting research here about awkwardness and empathy, and I thought sort of on the surface, it's sort of hard to imagine how those two go together, but some interesting research really shows some of the connection there.
Yeah, so basically while listening to that American Pie clip, if you were kind of just cringing and feeling super uncomfortable, I almost felt like I just had to take my headphones off and not listen to that. There is some really cool research by these neuroscientists in Germany who say that is linked to empathy, that people who are higher in empathy tend to experience more discomfort when other people are embarrassing themselves, even when, like, something fictional has happened, when they're reading something, when they're listening to something, when they're watching something. And I think that's pretty cool, actually. That says some really nice things about you if you are the kind of person who is more sensitive to these feelings.
So. Is there a part of our brain that seems to react to awkward moments?
There probably is. This is probably an awkward moment that I don't exactly remember which part. but you know, it's the part of us that cares about being pro-social and that cares about connecting with other people, and that cares about how other people feel, that tends to be higher in people who are more self-conscious and are more attuned to these moments. So,
well, let's talk about awkward silences.
Sure.
Which, again, I think we all have experienced that. How long does the silence go on when people begin to feel awkward?
Yeah, there was this awesome study, I think back in 2011, by Dutch researchers who they kind of timed this out, and they gave people a series of different scenarios where the silence lasted, I think, for 2 seconds and 4 seconds and 6 seconds. And they wanted to see how long did it take where it felt uncomfortable and they noticed, but not noticeable, like that they could tell the experimenters were messing with them or whatever. So about 4 seconds.
About 4 seconds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're going to do 4 seconds of silence on the radio.
Gosh,
here
yeah.
we go.
That's pretty bad, long. Right? Yeah,
it's really
a long
bad.
Time. Yeah, because when I've talked about this, people have been like, 4 seconds, that doesn't sound like too long. But it is if you're sitting there with someone and nothing's happening, you know, especially for Americans who tend to be pretty voluble. So
I wonder, too, whether, I mean, certainly you can't do 4 seconds on the radio, which we just did, but also that there is silence that can have a kind of dramatic effect.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you think of a play or a performance mm-hmm. or something. There's sometimes those moments of absolute quiet where you lean in.
Oh, yeah.
You want to know what's going on.
Absolutely. Or I say this in the book, an acquaintance of mine told me when I was researching this book about his former boss who people would come into this guy's office to ask for a raise or a promotion and the boss would just like sit there. And just like seconds would tick by silently. And the joke was that the employees would just like freak out and be like, oh, never mind, never mind, never mind. I'll take a pay cut. Like just to end the silence. So.
But you also write about how sometimes those silent, well, I guess how those silences can be empowering. And I guess for the boss, that person was in control of the situation.
Right. If you can learn to be comfortable with it, you know, I think it's I think especially in a work situation or maybe like in a negotiation situation, just to like say your point and then just leave it there and don't. I just feel like I kind of try to tap dance around the awkward silences sometimes and fill them when I maybe don't need to. I could just say this and then
let
wait,
it be.
You know? Yeah.
But I'm thinking of those social situations. You're at a party, you're meeting someone, you've gone through all the, you know, the who, what, where, when, whys.
Yeah.
And then there's this moment where,
and
it feels almost tangible between the two people.
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of the things I did for this book was I did use this weird, like, Tinder for Friends app. And so I went on a bunch of friend dates with women I'd never met before and haven't seen since. But but one of them, every time there was an awkward silence, she would just kind of say, like, let's see, what else, what else, what else? And it, uh-huh. and it wasn't weird. There was something about that where she kind of acknowledged that we'd come to an end of the road and it helped. It was kind of just acknowledging it and being like, oh, all right, moving on.
You also talk about when children, I guess, begin to have that sense of awkwardness.
Yeah. I thought this was so cool. So there's this pretty famous study called the mirror recognition test where you put babies around like 18 months old, kind of like before or around their second birthday in front of a mirror. Babies younger than 18 months old. I forgot. The trick is that you put something like a little post-it or something on their head and then you set them in front of a mirror. And babies younger than 18 months old kind of like don't notice it. They kind of just like, whatever, maybe play with the baby in the mirror. Maybe they don't. But starting around 18 months old or certainly by second birthday, it'll really bother the babies and they'll kind of look at it and they'll like, you know, try to mess with it or it really bothers them. And there's this psychologist, this developmental psychologist, Philippe Rochat, who believes that that is kind of the first instance of feeling self-conscious, of being aware that what we think we look like isn't always what other people are seeing and that difference bothers us, you know, that even if something as silly as like having a little yellow post-it on your head, that's not what the baby was expecting and that bothers them.
Why do we cringe at the sound of our own voice?
Yes, I love this. So, I mean, I've been doing radio shows and radio hosts have told me they can't listen back to their own voices, which just is really nuts to me. So basically, there's a physiological reason behind this. The way that I'm typically hearing my voice, I hear it through the air and I hear it through the bones of my own skull. And bone conduction transmits sound at a lower frequency than air conduction. So I really am hearing my voice at a lower frequency than or a lower pitch than if I would listen back to this this interview. I would be like, you know, well, a lot of people say that when they hear their voices, they say like,
oh,
like it's higher than I think. I sound like a teenager. You know, that's a really common thing to say. And so there is a reason for that. So, you know, when I was researching this, I was like, that's interesting. But why do we say that makes us cringe? And to me, that really illuminates this idea that the things that we say make us cringe are the moments that illuminate that there is this gap sometimes between the person we think we're presenting to the world and the person the world is actually seeing or hearing in this case. You know, I really am hearing myself this way. People really are hearing me a totally other way. And I can't always have access to the way that other people are hearing me. So that's why I think these moments can be really valuable. It's like an instant that takes you out of your own perspective and lets you see yourself from someone else's point of view. So,
thinking about and this, I think, becomes more apparent when you go to a high school reunion and you find out, you know, all the cool kids that didn't feel or look so awkward were actually feeling really awkward during their adolescence.
I know.
It's such a revelation.
Yeah. I mean, people, like, as I've been writing this book, people have kind of pulled me aside and been like, you know, thank you for writing this. I feel this way all the time. And it's people who, I don't know, my friends who like are journalists who go on TV all the time, you know, who I never would think feel uncomfortable like this. I think it's something we all feel to different degrees and different situations. But it's worth learning how to kind of ride out these situations with a little more success. And yeah.
What was the biggest revelation from doing all this research and all this writing?
That these aren't moments to avoid, that they really in the end kind of helped highlight for me just the sheer absurdity in the human experience, you know?
That was my April 2018 conversation with Melissa Dahl, author of Cringeworthy, A Theory of Awkwardness. And that wraps up today's Thanksgiving edition of Radio Times. Happy Thanksgiving from all of us at Radio Times, Debbie Builder, Kelsey Hansen, and John Ahrens, who edited today's show. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thanks for joining us.